Well, in the interest of time and lunch, I don't think that I'll make a little presentation. But I did want to just underline that we've been talking about the future, the present, digitized containers for things, archives and texts and so forth, and also had a look at the past. I'm a classicist too, so I'm always interested in what happened when we tried these things before, and quite conscious of how many forms that containers have taken over the millennia for human knowledge. Memory, as in the early forms of the Iliad, manuscripts, scroll books, codex books, tapes, microfilms, vinyl, CD-ROM, internet, each with virtues and deficiencies. Each was a kind of trade-off. The thing contained is never, you know, coextensive with the container, and the container doesn't always provide ultimate access to what it's attempting to contain. All of these forms give form to the knowledge that they contain, develop avenues of access to it, uses for it, use it to create new knowledge, and they also provide guides and gatekeepers to tell us and tell the media what can be in it. And each of these has its own pros and cons. Digitization has pros and cons and trade-offs too. And it even revives some obsolete methods. For instance, the codex book was invented to get rid of the scroll, so you didn't have to scroll. Now we have to scroll again if we're reading on a tablet, you know, so we get rid of the page for that. So there are all these trade-offs. It costs a lot of money to make these transitions in the past. A lot of classical literature was lost when the transition from roll to codex occurred. What was considered valuable to recopy into this new medium. And a lot of texts didn't make it. And so my first worry, and to ask for questions today, is what about the future? What is digitization accomplishing? I mean, it's on a macro scale, it's collecting things. How permanent is the collection of it? How expensive is it? My impression from talking about the digital library that I operate is that people have no idea how much it costs. And I'm glad that Juliana underlined this. It's not cheap. And you could give your archive to be preserved and to be reformatted every few years. But how long is that going to last? And what happens to the originals of which digital copies have been made? Is our work done when we have the digital copy? I still have some floppy disks just as souvenirs. I don't know how in the world I would ever read them now. So I'm just opening questions with the question of the future. Are we doing this for ourselves? If we're doing it for the future, how are we preparing for the future? And are we creating things or simply putting them in one kind of an archive or another? And does each archive sort of stand on its own for funding? If yours goes out of business, that's sad, but mine is still going because I have somebody to pay for it. Is there this interoperability and collaboration that we heard about with the Boston Public Library? That's wonderful, but the Boston Public Library is an old and wealthy institution, and these little places depend on it. And that's great, but what I'm interested in for the future, is there any macro commitment to a medium the way there was for the scroll that lasted about 900 years and then the codex lasted over a millennium, much more than that, and we're still using it. What's the investment in the future? Is it possible with digitization? Those are just a few ideas that come along with our theme of containers today. And so I open the floor for questions and comments from our panelists.
Thank you.
Maybe for David, what happens when the funding runs out for your clients? I mean, let's say the great-grandchild doesn't want to keep grandpa's books anymore, sort of like cryogenics.
Well, we've been at this for 32 years now, and that's long enough to see some of these collections take that route. And it's interesting to see where they end up and how that process takes place. We just had a collection this year, a television show, you might remember it, called Death Valley Days.
Oh yeah.
And Ronald Reagan was the host of that show for a few years. And that was one of those sponsored TV shows. It was sponsored by the U.S. Borax Corporation. 20 Mule Team Borax, yeah. And because it was a sponsored show, it had the weight of that corporation, which is now Rio Tinto Chemical, a global mining concern. But they hung on to this asset because there was a champion within the organization that said, no, this is important, this is a piece of our history, and we should hang on to this. So then they decided to digitize it, and they digitized it this last year. They spent millions of dollars. It's now available on Blu-ray at Target and Walmart. And then they shipped all the film off to LC this year. So Mike Michonne,
right,
has pallets and pallets of 16 millimeter high quality film, and they'll probably sit in those pallets for the next 20 years before he gets the budget to process them into his vault. That's an example of a migration like that.
Well, we're all cultures are always cultures, and cultural knowledge is always fighting what Ovid calls the voracious aging process, adux vetustas. So it's probably never a sure thing that things will last forever. But is our sense that the digital medium has this in mind, that digitizers are confident about the effort?
No, not at all, because nothing is permanent. And that's the thing about, especially with video, but anything digitized, there's no, unless the scientists get to it, there's no permanence. So you've got to go in and check things and make sure that they're still there. You've got to keep re-migrating. And that's, you cannot let it just sit there, you know. And even my fear with the things that we have at the Library of Congress, because I was specifically interested, you mentioned, in spinning disk technology. I kept asking them about it, but they only had limited. But I know this, the digitization is more expensive and takes more time. Now, it has the capacity to give more access, but even with that, you've got to have the metadata. I mean, all those things to go along with it.
Yeah, it's very expensive.
It's expensive.
But once you step onto that roadway, you never step off.
You no.
constantly have to migrate.
That's right. And, you know, in my case, I mean, we were forced into it because our machines, we had recorded on analog. Those, I mean, people in the video, there was no, like, they were not manufacturing the machines anymore. And so we had to move into a digitized form, or the collection would have gone away.
I think that's why, just to get back to one of my points in my presentation, that's why access is so important. I don't see, you know, preservation as, and access as these two separate things. And we could talk about spinning disks, and we could talk about, you know, a traditional model of storage and permanence. I've come to think of digital preservation in this weird way as, I think of it more like language. A language will survive if it's spoken. And yes, it mutates and it adapts and it changes. And in a weird way, this is kind of this, I don't know, a leap of faith. So if we make our collections more accessible and assure, and I feel like part of my job is to make sure that, you know, beyond discovery and delivery, these collections are used and they're inserted into the cultural conversation. That's true. So yeah, I mean, not everything's permanent. Communication is permanent. Culture is permanent. So my job is to insert these things into the cultural dialogue, and that's how it survives, and in more of a spiritual way than like a physical way.
I was fascinated by your about the Yorubas and about what users are doing with the collections. That's one thing that I found in the Loeb Library that I do, that we can tell what the users are doing, every keystroke. You know, what are they searching for? What books are they looking at? What books do they look at after they look at the one they went to look at? We were afraid when we digitized the library that it would cannibalize the print library, which it reproduces. But actually, it's helping both, because people can now discover other books that they wouldn't have if they just had the print to go on. And also, we're discovering what people are interested in, which is very shocking to me sometimes, because I would expect Homer, Virgil, Plato. No, I mean, there are people reading all sorts of weird things out there.
And they might not—they might not even be. What we're finding too is they might not be reading it. There might be, maybe there's one photograph in there. Maybe there's a passage. Maybe there's something particular about the language it was written in. Like, we don't even know what the true value of. It might not be for the narrative itself. It might be for something else.
It's also, this is an unusual capacity for of digital containers, is that they can interact and they can collaborate. There's interoperability that. Scrolls and codices and other forms of recording could never do. And I wonder how you feel about the future of the interoperable and interactive aspects of the medium.
Well, can I ask a question?
You've been standing there for a while.
I'd like to talk. Tom, you say digital preservation as though that's one thing and as though that's obvious. And part of my kind of concern is that digitization is not preservation. It can be part of a set of preservation practices.
Yep.
But we need to unpack that really carefully, as I think the examples from the history vaults and the history, the Hollywood vaults and the history makers show, right, that preservation takes a lot of forms. Digitization is not preservation in and of itself.
Yep, I totally agree. Yeah.
And I think your point, Jeffrey, about migration of forms being how cultural objects survive, right? That's what Ovid says. I will be read so long as people speak Latin, right?
Right.
And you know, the latest form of Ovid's poetry is in fact on the digital Loeb Classical Library. So that's a kind of an activation of these things in our contemporary culture. But I worry from the perspective of cultural heritage preservation that we will lose things. We will allow ourselves to lose things if we don't make this commitment towards the physical. Right? The case of microfilm is a really stunning example, and not long ago. And I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir in this room, but I would say it's up to you librarians to make clear what your practices are, what the relationship between going digital and preservation of other kinds of materials and media is. That's on
okay.
you.
Yeah. Can I just? This was all fascinating and a wonderful wonderful range of projects talked about. And Stephanie, I want to reassure you. I'm a trained humanist. I am not a trained librarian, but I just did spend a decade in the libraries, and I plan to spend a lot more time in them. And let me assure you, librarians think in the long term. There has been discussion of the materiality of our digitized cultural heritage that has a decades-long record in the literature.
No, I know that's true.
So,
as well.
So
yeah.
The materiality of both the artifacts digitized, which is what you're talking about, and the materiality of the digital, right? Digital humanities has been talking about this. Electronic literature has been talking about this. Libraries have been talking about this.
That's right.
For actual decades. I think admonishing us to not throwing anything away is, I don't even know how to address that. We don't throw some things away, and we do throw other things away. And there are long and very careful thought processes and conversations around that that I don't think you acknowledged. And
I mean, there are, but it's also true that we've sort of failed in the past at this, I think.
We have also had fires in libraries in the past.
Absolutely.
We have failed as humanity in the past. You know, if we're talking about permanent preservation, then let's talk about the permanence of humanity, but I don't think that that's a productive conversation to have right now. I think, Jeffrey, what you're looking for is a macro commitment to medium. I mean, there's computing itself, right, which is right now binary, and we're looking into quantum computing, and we don't even know if that's going to happen. Right, the ones and zeros versus different, materially different kinds of computing. But there do exist best practices for digital preservation, and I do want to assure you, the digital preservation is a thing. Digitization in itself is not preservation, but nobody in the libraries says that it is. And we have long established best practices for at least the preservation of bits of the ones and zeros that make up digital files.
Sure, I understand that, but I also see a colleague like Tom putting a slide up to say we have Helen Keller's bathing suit, when what we have is a record of Helen Keller's bathing suit and an image of Helen Keller's bathing suit. And that is not the same. So we are making shortcuts in the ways we are talking about these things.
The humanity that has internet access will never be able to see the physical bathing suit.
That's why digitization is a form of access and not a form of preservation.
But that bathing suit is going to rot at some point unless it's in David's.
I can tell you, it's in a closet in the Fisk Public Library.
But listen, let's give credit to the preservation specialists that have been serving you for centuries, and give some credit to all of that not being done thoughtlessly.
Well, maybe there was some reaction, but I would say that there has been a lot of discussion and about how things are done, and that in your case, Tom, a lot of the work that you did, you were going into systems that had already established metadata and processes, you know, because when
sometimes,
you were, well, you were talking about Internet Archive, and you were also talking about
those guys, on that end, yes.
Right, on that end. And I think that how you set things up is absolutely important, and doing that consultation ahead of time is really important, because once you start down that path, you have to be in that path for the long term. And things will be changing, and you have to keep up with the changes.
Do you think that this medium, that it's a defect or a virtue that there are so many different formats, that people have a project and they do it always in a little bit different way? So it's you know, a codex book is pretty much a codex book. There are all sorts of sizes and shapes of it, but it's basically that idea. Whereas digital media are difficult for many users to use in their most efficient way. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even simple ones if you're not digitally literate. And I wonder if there is a concern about getting too far ahead of the public, that there are features that are built in, and Steve Jobs would be the first to look at this. When he looked at the phone, he said, look at all those buttons. No one knows how to use that. It can do everything, but you don't know how to operate it. So what if you had a phone that you didn't, you know, what about the sites? Are sites getting too difficult or less difficult? Or is that a problem looking down the road? In other words, we create a site to do our particular project, but then the medium changes so that maybe our site isn't.
Yeah, but I, I, th- think the back end is really important, the structure. We're XML back. I mean, no, I think the back end, if you're all set with your back end, you can migrate to other things pretty easily.
And it's an argument for digital literacy for teaching coding in schools, yep. And I think that's really essential. There's there to teach the tools to have access. Yeah, Michelle.
Hi, so I'm an academic librarian who is not an expert in digital preservation, you know, just to be honest, but I would say that my impression of the state of digital preservation in academic libraries, I'm a little skeptical, and I think that having conversations for decades and the existence of best practices is not the same as a robust, reliable system of digital preservation. And, you know, for we know how to preserve books, we know museums know how to preserve artifacts, and I don't believe, actually, that the systems are there yet. So I'm very sympathetic to Stephanie, but we've talked about this before.
Many times.
Yeah, it's definitely a work in progress. I missed the first two sessions here because I was actually at a meeting of the AP Trust, which is the Academic Preservation Trust. And you know, one component of that is talking about spinning disks and hardware and cloud storage and you know, where are you putting the stuff and where is it backed up and is it distributed enough? And that's a component of digital preservation, you know, the distributed, you know, lots of copies, keep stuff safe and all that. What I was really impressed with is that this was my first meeting, is how community-based it is. And I think that's what's going, there's a very non-digital, non-technical aspect to digital preservation, and that is, as you were saying, you know, engaging in an active community and understanding that we can't do this ourselves. That this isn't about every library digitizes their stuff and puts it away in their particular spot.
But when you say community-based, what do you mean by community-based?
So it can mean a couple different things. Number one, acknowledging the fact that we don't have it perfected yet and having conversations to build tools, you know, down to the very technical, like how do you move 16 terabytes of data from one site to another in an efficient and inexpensive way. I mean, that's the you know, technical strategy behind digital preservation. You know, you put your stuff here, here, and here. I keep a copy of your stuff. You keep a copy of my stuff. If something goes down, it restores. And there is you know, actual technology that runs checksums on digital files that will, you know, measure, like look at every single, not to get too technical here, but you know, look at every single bit and byte and make sure that it's the same. And there is, you know, there's a you know.
No, it's just when you use community, I mean, people use community in different ways. I usually talk about partnerships, not community. When I talk about when I think of community, right. I think of community, people who are doing community archives and things like that. Though that is, I don't know how ultimately they will be sustainable unless they are associated with a real, you know, someone who has computing power or real money to support all of those things, because it all costs tremendous amounts of money, millions of dollars,
So the non-technical answer to that is being invested in everybody else's collections. The Jamaica Plain Historical Society, to me, is just as important as my collection.
That's a nice segue to a question I had, actually. Okay. I'd like to get off the train here on preservation and access and ask a practical question of Mr. Blake. I'm really, really impressed by everybody's presentation today, but I especially like the detail you gave us. My question is really rather pedestrian, but what happens, or do you have any idea what will happen to institutions like the North Adams Library and the Anthony Griffin Museum once their asset is actually consolidated at the Boston Public Library? Would that additional access through the BPL result in more people going to the Griffin Museum, or will it mean that those are going to be shuttered and libraries will consolidate in the same way that other industries have consolidated and you guys effectively become the Walmart of information?
In my experience, it's the... Wait, what order did you say that in? It's the former. No. Yes. More people are coming. When I worked at Mass Historical, the John Adams correspondence and the Abigail Adams correspondence all went online, and the reading room shot up. I can attest to that. The more, and a lot of it is because it's not digitization per se. It's actually you've even though you've made it accessible to a broader range of people, you've also let a broader range of people know it exists, and that just scales up. So people will always want to see the original. People will, like you said, I mean, we have tons of people in our reading room all the time. They want to come see the original.
I mean, that sounds great. I'd like to believe that. It would be really great if places like BPL would get some data behind that.
Sure.
And actually demonstrate that is the case. Yeah. We assume that access promotes more people to content, but the evidence of that is...
Yeah, no, it's weird because
our
audience is now huge, but also anonymous, and it's actually very tough to get, it's hard to say, how many more people would have come here.
I think the information is being accessed more through the BPL, but the fate of these small institutions and museums and little libraries is really more...
Some of them don't even exist physically. I mean, a lot of these small historical societies we work with, they don't even have a physical presence, so you couldn't even see this stuff. One of the historical societies I work with, they literally just go through eBay and look for stuff related to the neighborhood, and then they have it sent directly to us to digitize. Mm-hmm. So, and then the physical stuff goes in a filing cabinet in the director's office or something like that.
I think you answered my question.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
I have a question about your partnerships with innovative companies and maybe startups, and your general, it would be interesting to get a inside view into your financial planning and thinking about future technologies. So, for example, to talk about the merging of digitization and materiality of archives and physicality of historical objects, obviously 3D printing is around the corner. It's not as probably evident right now, but in about 10 years, 3D printers are going to be around. That probably more applicable to, let's say, BPL collection. In the case of history makers, holographic presentations, so holographs are going to be around in about 10, maybe 10, maybe 20 years. And so, for example, now, in order for you to save money and maybe introduce these technologies into libraries and attract, kind of see if we can actually bring the future sooner rather than later. Have you thought about finding grants or sponsors, or maybe, as I said, working with startups who would maybe even come and work with you for free under a certain arrangement, so that you would take a not just a video, but a holographic video, whatever it's called, or be able to create metadata in these digital files so that, 10 years from now, you'll be able to replicate a historical artifact. So again, with an example of a swimsuit, maybe I won't be able to fly to whatever, where the Boston or, where it is, but I'll be able to print a swimsuit in Ireland or China or Russia, etc. So.
That's the most exciting part of my job, is just trying to imagine what's unimaginable. And part of my job now, as my official title is content discovery manager, so this is just the first step, digitizing, whether it's a component of preservation or whatever we decide here. The next step is getting it used and getting it put on whatever emerging technological platforms are out there. I invite anybody, if you have a wacky idea what to do with our stuff. People know me at work for the guy who's always bringing tours through. This kid came in, he has no money. The reason he has no money, he has augmented reality goggles, and he was showing me a prototype of a book that just appears in the room. So I pointed him to the Internet Archive. I said, you could download the entire John Adams library, which for us, if you don't know this already, is actually gonna go off site for the next 2 years because we're renovating our physical space. Love to get some of your ideas, actually. So the John Adams library goes away, but you can come into the library and put on virtual goggles and read the John Adams library. I mean, you look silly because you're standing in the middle of a room going like this, but I mean, it's just those kinds of things that we're always looking to engage. That's why I'm here. I think the emergence of digital humanities are you guys are coming up with things that I never would have thought of. Beyond just the fabric of Helen Keller's bathing suit, you know, we've digitized and created really robust metadata for our anti-slavery abolitionist letters. So not because we've encoded, you know, recipients, dates, authors. I've seen, I don't know if any of you know Caleb McDaniel at Rice, but he's taken all of the metadata from those letters about dates and stuff, and he's created a visualization of the network. So we haven't just recreated the letters, we recreated the network of abolitionists and, you know, who was contacting who at one time, and you could visually see through these connections like how the abolitionist movement grew and evolved in New England. I thought I was just scanning a bunch of letters. So it's pretty cool.
We have time for one more quick one, I'm afraid.
I'll have to use the mic somewhere. I don't know if you can hear me,
but ice cream cone.
Okay, ice cream cone. Okay. I'm an archivist.
Yes.
At a local academic institution, and sort of a question that came into my mind that is not one that will be answered simply or in this room or in multiple forums, but there are many, many opportunities as technology evolves and develops, the many, many tools we can use. And how do we really get the tools, the digitization, the physical objects, and the materiality to all work together? Because it's not a single way of learning anything. Mm-hmm. As Tom Mullaney showed yesterday, there's brilliant ways that people can use technology to enhance our ability to understand a topic or to get our heads around it. But when Tom, you said, not to pick on you, but digitize this small historical society, no one actually visits them, it goes to you, it gets digitized, and then it goes back in that file cabinet. So I worry what happens to that file cabinet and those, the mm-hmm. tangible, the material things that, you know, and the possibilities are out there for holograms and all sorts of things. But is a hologram of someone or a bathing suit, just to follow that thread, the same as the bathing suit, which these will all crumble over time. I mean, time takes its toll on all of us. But what do we do to get also that information literacy, historical knowledge, that learning opportunity, that just because it's been digitized, we can put it in the file cabinet, oh, well, maybe we can throw it out too. Have we lost something? And that's a bigger conversation that I think is a broader, more public conversation mm-hmm. to get more participation in that, about how do we teach children in schools that there's this thing, it doesn't exist just on the web, mm-hmm. and what does it mean to touch that thing in your community or on a broader scale? So just a comment.
I thank you. I think we also overestimate how quickly things fall apart. Right, that this is a phrase that has been sort of repeated over and over again, is that it will molder on the shelves, it will eventually degrade. Sure, it will, and different materials have different lifespans, film being one that's actually very flammable and thus very, very delicate. And
the film can last 100 years and you can re-migrate it.
Indeed, and we hear the same things about papyrus too. Papyrus had a lifetime of, 400 years or so. Codices are really permanent. Newspapers last longer than the microfilm operators will tell us they did. So there is really, to me, a responsibility from that side as well, that we don't buy into these narratives of the destruction of the physical destruction of the past. That is overstated in the same way that, yes, there are answers about digitization and access, but I think the point about what happens to the file cabinet is really well taken.
Yeah, I've never thought of this as I'm creating surrogates. I've thought of this as creating a complement, or a complement to the collections. This was never meant to be a replacement. I see people with the actual book next to them and a laptop next to them, and they're reading through the digital copy that we put up on the Internet Archive here, because it's keyword searchable. They can go to a certain page, and then they look at the physical book, and they're using them both side by side. So.
Yeah, we find that too at the Loeb Library, that the digital version is an exact copy of the print version, but people use the two for different reasons.
Using them differently, yeah.
I tell my students, you don't have to buy the book for class, you can use it online. They buy the book.
Oh, yeah.
Because they can't.
Because they can mark it up, they can put highlighters on it. And
right,
stuff like
but
that.
They search online, because you can't search the library very well in the physical form.
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid that we're even cannibalizing our lunch. So, but thanks so much for such a wonderful, rich panel. And
thank you.
Everyone for
eat fast if you can, and we'll hope to start as close to our 1:30, maybe 1:40 time for lunch as we can.
There's only six of us.
I think about 1:30. Because it's self-service.